We know that people who have rheumatoid arthritis have given two opinions, overwhelming opinions. One is 97% of patients, this was a UK study, said that stress affected their rheumatoid arthritis symptoms, pain in their joints, stiffness, all that stuff. The other is their 66% says they believe that stress preceded their new disease. And that's where the thinking is going now.
Dr. Andrew Holman, thanks for joining me on the podcast today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I have to be honest. I'm typically a bit skeptical. Actually, I'm worse than that. I'm probably a cynic in regards to the medical system. And hearing about what you and your company is working on, it's one of those rare moments that I have a little hope as far as what people are doing out there in the chronic disease world. And I'm interested in learning more. And it seems like you got there from a background of rheumatology, if I understand.
That's right.
Yeah. So it'd be interesting to hear how you bridge the gap from being a rheumatologist to this exciting new frontier of helping people get better.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm an in-the-trenches rheumatologist. I have an academic appointment, but I was just, you know, face-to-face with patients for 30 years in South Seattle. I have an interesting background in that I come from a family of lawyers and judges. So I usually remind people I don't think exactly like most of my peers. A little bit more open-minded, but then also dependent on rigorous evidence. So rheumatology is the study of autoimmune disease. So everyone does internal medicine. They subspecialize. People know about other specialties. There aren't very many rheumatologists. Only about 3,800 in the country practicing. But we take care of mostly young women, young men too, who have rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, other autoimmune diseases. A lot of those things you see on TV where they're jumping in the pool, ask your doctor if this is right for you. And, I mean, we've got some things in the last 20 years that are bona fide miracles. You know, we no longer have wheelchairs in our office. That doesn't mean we don't have a long way to go. And I studied fibromyalgia, which was particularly challenging, but we made a lot of progress on understanding what it was and a few basic things. So happy to talk about also where that led us to develop a company to measure the autonomic nervous system through the FDA. But for your audience, I think they're probably interested to know that I'm very closely aligned with a lot of the things that you probably I rely on in life, and you find answers in unexpected places depending on where you're coming from. So happy to delve into that.
Sure. So it seems like, for a little context, I mean, you said rheumatology is essentially the study of autoimmune disease. I've heard different opinions of like what's underlying, like what an autoimmune disease really is, like what's going on or what's driving it. Do you have a take with the 30 years experience you have of like how you define why they show up in someone and like what they are, what's driving them? I know like growing rapidly across the population.
Yeah. So the immune system is very important, right? If it doesn't work, you don't survive infancy. So, and it's working all the time and there are many layers to it. It's like the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, the Special Forces. I mean, there's all these components with different proteins we call cytokines, B cells, T cells, macrophages. I mean, it goes, you know, there's a lot, right? So when you become a rheumatologist, you're really the specialty that understands the immune system. The problem is it's usually well-directed against pathogens and viruses and bacteria. I mean, every time you brush your teeth or floss, you put bacteria into your bloodstream that could kill you, right? But your immune system is there to knock them out before they get on your heart valves and give you endocarditis and die. So that's happening all the time, right?
Brushing teeth and flossing is bad. I should stop.
No, not bad. No, it's just, it's very good for your teeth. It's just, thank goodness your immune system's there to do its job, right? So we do have people who don't have an immune system. So you know about people who live in bubbles and so forth. I mean, it's a very serious problem. My world is where the immune system is overactive. It's just bizarrely attacking you. And they have different targets. Sometimes it's the joints. Sometimes it's the kidneys, the brain, the nerves, the blood vessels. So there are many different kinds of autoimmune where you're attacking yourself by mistake. So our our role, usually we jump in when you're suffering, and we try to do something about it. We try to put the train back on the tracks, try to get the immune system to behave itself. The immune system is exceptionally powerful. I mean, it should be, right? You don't want to just turn off by accident one day, you know. That leads to all kinds of challenges. And then to your point, you know, where did it come from? Why? Why you? Why did this happen? So with the advent of genetic testing, we know now that, for instance, the number one autoimmune disease in my world is rheumatoid arthritis, a crippling disease of men and women, but mostly women, younger age. Children can get it too. It's devastating, destroys the joints and many other things. And we know there's a genetic predisposition. So identical twins, right? 30% what we call concordance, where the other twin will get rheumatoid arthritis, no matter what we do.
That but means 70% won't.
Don't, right.
So wouldn't that be the case? Can't you use the same data to say a case that that's not genetic then?
Oh, well, 30% is much more than any other relation to your sister, brother, or anything like that. Okay. So it's much more commonly seen in an identical twin than would be expected. You know, so we know there's a signal there. The other thing you may be fascinated by is I like something called paleopathology. It's kind of so rheumatoid arthritis causes a specific erosion or damage to the joint that's recognizable in a fossilized bone. You know, damage occurs in different shapes and sizes and forms, right? Those erosions have been seen in North America since anybody's ever been here. And Native Americans suffer from rheumatoid arthritis quite prominently compared to everybody else. However, there were no erosions like that in Europe before Columbus. So it looks like whatever causes this in the susceptible genetic individual is probably transmissible. So syphilis, you know, came from the New World to Europe. Smallpox came from Europe to the New World, right? And it looks like rheumatoid arthritis traveled as well. The third leg of the tripod is, okay, you have the right genetics or wrong genetics or whatever, and you're exposed to whatever. We haven't found it yet, but there seems to be something. Why you? Well, there's actually information out of Amsterdam that addresses that question. And it may be the stress response that affects your immune system. So if you're under chronic stress, with epinephrine, adrenaline, that type of thing, not just anxiety, we're not talking about that. We're talking about adrenaline responses, which can drive behavior, but just a little different than that.
Also, you're defining stress as like anything that stimulates your body to use stress hormones to alter metabolic processes or try to meet the energetic demand.
Run from the tiger, whatever. But it also affects the immune system, as you would expect. If you're under threat, you'd want your immune system to ramp up, right? Turn on the gas. And it does. And we've been able to define what parts of the immune system and relative to other people. Well, it looks like that process may be going on in the background of people who develop rheumatoid arthritis, maybe lupus, maybe MS, maybe cancer as well. We know that people who have rheumatoid arthritis have given two opinions, overwhelming opinions. One is 97% of patients, this was a UK study, said that stress affected their rheumatoid arthritis symptoms, pain in their joints, stiffness, all that stuff.
Everybody, basically. Stress 60, makes everybody worse.
Various different mechanisms to do that. But in the immune system, autoimmunity, they're quite sure that that's the story. The other is their 66% says they believe that stress preceded their new disease. And that's where the thinking is going now. So stress is a huge deal, right? I don't tell you that. It's great if you need it, but it's not good if it's on all the time. It's not productive. And we know that the human body pays a price. So anything we can do in traditional medicine, non-traditional medicine, integrative medicine, wellness, to kind of calm the sympathetic fight or flight response, the gas of this part of the neuroanatomy, looks like it's advantageous. And it's just starting to bubble into traditional medicine. So like, right, we've been behind. Patients are telling us, we believe you, we just don't know what to do. But that changes when you can measure something, right? When you can actually measure it with precision, right? So that's really what's happening now. Everything that patients know is right. It turned out they were right all along. Doctors were suspecting it, but they weren't sure how to apply their wiring to it. Other kinds of clinicians, like naturopathic doctors, integrative doctors, they were already applying. They were already going after it. But the traditional MDs and some DOs were catching up now. And that's because technology is helping us see the problem in terms we understand. Biochemistry.
Before we begin today's episode, I want to share something really special with you, something I've been pouring my heart into. If you've been feeling tired in a way that sleep doesn't fix, if you've noticed you're carrying tension all the time, or you're stuck in that cycle of pushing, achieving, caring for everyone else, and running on empty, I've created something just for you. It's a weekend retreat called The Deep Unwind, and I'll be guiding it in person at the beautiful Art of Living Retreat Center in the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Carolina. This experience is for the helpers, the overthinkers, the high achievers, the sensitive souls, the ones who are strong for everyone else, but craving a safe place to finally put down the heavy weight of responsibility and let their shoulders relax. Together, we'll spend the weekend slowing down and gently unwinding the patterns that lead to burnout and self-criticism. Through somatic practices, guided hypnotherapy, nervous system healing, and myofascial release, you'll learn how to feel safe in your body again. You'll learn how to soften your inner critic, and you'll experience how to truly rest. Not just collapse or detach, but to deeply restore. You'll leave feeling lighter, clearer, more grounded, and more connected to yourself than you've felt in a long time. And everyone who joins us will receive a myofascial release kit with my favorite tools that I personally use and teach with, plus a signed copy of my book so you can continue the work at home. If this sounds like exactly what your nervous system has been asking for, I'd love to meet you there. You can learn more and reserve your spot at themindfulmovement.com/retreat. I look forward to welcoming you to The Deep Unwind.
If you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you've probably heard me talk about how important it is to regulate your nervous system. This goes for healing, for focus, for just overall emotional well-being. But the reality is that even if we know the tools to help do this, whether it's breathing or meditation or just slowing down, it can still be really hard to stay regulated throughout a busy day. That's one reason I've really been interested in the Apollo wearable by Apollo Neuro. Sarah and I both use this device regularly and have found it very beneficial. It's a small wearable device that uses gentle vibrations, and they're designed to signal safety to your nervous system. What's fascinating is that those signals can help your body shift out of a stress state and into a calmer, more regulated state. What I like about it most of all is that even though it can work great alongside practices like meditation or breath work, the real value is that you can wear it throughout your day, even while you're at work, and just let it work its magic on your nervous system. The other standout use that I rely on is wearing it to bed. Not only does it help me fall asleep fast, but I often wake up around 3 a.m. and I can just tap the button on it and it will help lull me back to sleep quickly. If you want to learn more, check out the podcast episode with the founder, David Rabin, and you could explore more about the technology itself. But if you're someone that struggles with anxiety or feeling wired or overwhelmed, or you're simply looking for more nervous system support in daily life, it might be something worth exploring. You can learn more about the Apollo wearable and how it works and save $99 on a new device at apolloneuro.com/mindful or click the link in the show notes. I promise you won't regret this investment. I truly believe it's the best bang for the buck in the wellness tech space.
This is, we're a very fascinating bag of chemicals. And I believe there's more to it. I'm a pretty spiritual guy. I think there's more than just a bag of chemicals. But I was an organic chemist before I became a rheumatologist, right? So I'm fascinated by stuff like that. We're now learning that that the stress response controlled in the brain by the autonomic nervous system, the ANS, that's what people will be reading all about this, is bubbling to the forefront of care so that we we take it into account. Sure, it's not the same thing as the disease, but it can drive it. And if it drives it, it impairs my performance that you're counting on.
Gotcha. It makes a lot of sense. It's like, I'm sure everybody can relate to the idea of like how they feel different when they know they're under stress and when they're calm. And, you know, stress comes in ways where you could be under stress and not really realize it. You could override it with a good mental outlook, or just the fact that stress hormones could make you feel energized and good. Like, people like going on roller coasters, or some people do. But it's interesting. So what you're working on is kind of bridging the gap of language almost, because in your field, you need to be able to communicate how you're quantifying or qualifying someone's state of stress to an industry that is kind of handcuffed to some degree by how they have like to set certain systems and processes in their like daily practice. So you need like a target indicator or something. And from what I understand, you are honing in on HRV, which probably most of our listeners have heard of. We've talked a little bit about it on the podcast, but maybe give a little overview on heart rate variability and why your company InMedics, am I saying that right? InMedics?
InMedics, right.
InMedics.
InMedics, yeah.
Is like, I guess, leaning on that to kind of drive, to kind of really shift the scale of how the industry works to help support people to have a more likely positive outcome.
Yeah, thanks. You're exactly right. So the rest of the world is not always ready for innovation, right? Now, do no harm. You know, it's important we don't chase every shiny object, right? Because patients are relying on us. They trust us, right? So we have to vet these things. But what's happened is heart rate variability, HRV, is provided as a consumer tool. Most people wear. I keep an eye on Whoop. I think they're an interesting company out of Boston. and what they do is they look at your heartbeat and they look at the timing. The timing of the beat is very important because it changes during respiration. When you breathe, you change pressures in your chest, right? Bring air in, bring air out. That inspiration and exhalation actually changes the heart rate, so that if you have a heart rate of 60, it's not a beat every second. It's not a metronome. It's a 1.1 seconds between, then 0.9, then 1.1. And that's normal. That's completely normal. That's what a healthy person should be doing. What was discovered about 150 years ago is that if you put people under stress, that variability between the beats, it disappears. So it's an indirect way of understanding what the brain, the stress response, is doing to the resting heart rate. Now, you could look at pupillary dilatation, you could look at thermography, you could look at all kinds of things that the autonomic nervous system also controls. It's just easier to look at the heart rate at rest, right? So what we found is a very traditional, well-studied heart rate variability in the medical literature was just kind of, you know, it was reasonable mathematics, because you're just applying math to an EKG. Measuring those time differences in milliseconds. But there were mathematicians that came up with a better mousetrap.
And that's that mouse... that's like trying to represent the flexibility of like the looseness of the heart, that it could kind of roll with the punches in real time, essentially.
You're right. A lot of people talk about that flexibility, that adaptive ability, you know, in those kinds of terms. And you're right. And that's very important for a healthy, functioning person, right? So when you lose that, we know there's all kinds of things can be a problem. But to measure it, to try to quantify it, to give you a number that we can kind of anchor to say, well, we need to get this better or worse. It's like a blood pressure. We know if you have a certain blood pressure, your risk of heart disease, stroke, and kidney failure goes up. So we check your blood pressure, right? And we'd like you to stay at a certain level where those people just seem to live longer and do better, right? and there's a lot of science of why blood pressure might be a strain on the heart or the kidneys or whatever. Now we're at the point where we're looking at autonomic HRV and looking at the two parts, the sympathetic go, 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 like the gas, which we all know what that feels like, and the parasympathetic, which was rest and restorative, which is supposed to be on at night to help you recover so you have a better day tomorrow. right? We need to recover as humans, right? You need that downtime. So you have the gas and the brake, pretty much. And if you live your life and are wired genetically so that the gas is always on a little bit more, it's kind of like driving a car, for those of us who used to drive manual cars, where your RPMs are like 3,500 instead of like 1,300, right? You probably relate. The engine is like working a little hard. I still drive a manual,
for the record. I'm an old head.
Yeah. So you don't need to do that. When I talk to folks, I explain a lot of stuff. We try to relate as best we can. We are forced in life sometimes to drive down that freeway at 80 miles an hour, white knuckle, just to get through the day and make everything, you know, get home, right? But some of us are in fifth gear and some are in third gear. It looks the same on the outside. We'd rather be driving 35 down a country road, a sunny day in a convertible, right? We'd rather do that. We don't get that choice. So we got to push that engine. What we're learning now is the autonomic nervous system is responsible for a kind of what RPMs you're running at. So this is very kind of holistic, non-MD way of putting things. But there are people looking at longevity, right? Lee Hood is on our board, if people might know who he is. Other people who look at, you know, what does it take to have a long, healthy life and avoid all the troubles we'd like to avoid? Well, there's plenty of things, good nutrition, sanitation. There's all kinds of things that help you live better and longer. But one of them is trying to control the stress response if you're wired to have it be on too much and potentially harm you. The question is, I can't tell who you are looking at you.
And well, it's funny you say that, though, because like you mentioned, you can't tell from the outside. It looks like somebody could be in third gear or fifth gear, and it looks the same. But also, I think you do see, like, you could see somebody walking, and if there's, like, a rigidity, it almost makes me think of that flexibility. Like you said, your heart rate could be 0.9, it could be 1.1, and they're, but it's like some people have a looseness and a comfort to the way they move, and some people, even though they won't probably tell you you're stressed, but there's something that every human, if they watched them, there's something, or you see it in athletes. Like, the best athletes have, like, if you're watching a boxing match, like the best are so explosive in the moment of the strike, and there's something about how they instantaneously come back to like cool and collective, and they lose that rigidity. I mean, I think it could show up, but it's, you know, then it's subject to the subjective eye trying to determine that, obviously. So it is obviously good to have a tool, and in your field, you need a tool. You can't just eyeball stuff because you could be wrong, or, you know, you could be biased.
You're exactly right. So I study musculoskeletal stuff. That's what we do in rheumatology. I study hypermobility syndromes, all kinds of stuff. So I thought I was pretty good after 25 years of kind of telling who the stress people were.
Right.
But you get some, you become more humble when you do a double-blind prospective study, and you take care of people in a study for a year for the rheumatoid arthritis, yet you check this marker a year ago and then you unblind it to see, were they? And what I found is half the time I was wrong. Half the time we've got people whose life is just chaos and they're complaining. They don't like it. Yet their brain manages the chaos in a constructive way that doesn't appear to be harming their immune system or their cardiovascular system. It's just a blessing. Some people run faster than others. What can I tell you? We don't know why. But other people look cool as a cucumber, and they've got one foot in the grave and the other on the banana peel. I mean, they have no idea. And of course, as a clinician, I have to be very worried about not ever missing something like that, right? So that, I think, is what coming to the future is a way to quantify what we think really matters here. And I think we're preaching to the choir most of the time. It's just that now in 5 minutes in the doctor's office, quiet, just lying down, pads on your wrists and ankles, no chest leads, very friendly for staff and patients. You just lie there, look at the ceiling. And then after 5 minutes, it goes to the cloud. We do the special math that's FDA cleared. And then the doctor has it on the iPad, numbers. Numbers for your sympathetic and your parasympathetic. First time in history, you can give both.
Why do you need straps on both wrists and ankles?
To get the EKG signal. So, like, if you know, people have a fitness device, there's a green light underneath here. See that?
Right, yeah.
That's called photoplethysmography. Everybody's learning new words today. The photoplethysmography gives you a pulse, right? So it can do a lot of things. AFib, if it's FDA cleared, certainly pulse rate. But it's not accurate enough to know exactly where the beat is to measure millisecond differences between. So you have to have an EKG source of information that's better than any cardiac care unit in the world. FDA requires that. Or you might as well just do math on whatever. You need to know where the beat is if you're measuring the timing between the beats with precision. And that's half of why FDA stepped in to make sure that accuracy, safety, you know, are all met. So, and that's part of the advantage. That's why we went to FDA instead of maybe another consumer tool.
And it just takes a few minutes. I'm sure you've done like boatloads of these. These readings. So, I mean, given the same person, do you see a lot of variability from like time of day or like weekend or weekday, middle of the work week? Like, is it kind of, do you have to compile a bunch of readings to get like a typical trend or average for someone?
I would have bet the ranch that I'd have to. And it turns out with all the studying of this particular advanced version that we do, which again, no one else has in the world, it varies about 15% during the day, unless you do something to somebody, like hit their car or they're late or whatever, they run up the stairs. I mean, the idea is this is a test done at rest in a quiet room in a doctor's office. So we try to control it, like a resting blood pressure. You know, if they check your blood pressure after you've been running around the building, it's not normal, you know, it's high.
They're always checking when you're in the doctor's office, where it's always a little worse.
Well, we want you to sit down and kind of breathe and take it easy, you know. We try to standardize it. So we want to know, how are you at rest? Because if you're sympathetic, fight or flight, active at rest, then you are the rest of the day even more, right? So how chill can you be? Well, this is the best you can do. We need to talk.
Gotcha. You said it could vary 15%. Is that a lot? Does that matter?
So I'll throw another term at you called the minimum important clinical difference. How much difference matters, right? When we look at things that matter, it's like 200-300% different. Two to three X. So 15% is well within, you know, still a very useful test.
So what you're saying, and at least within the world of rheumatology and your experience, and I assume it's in other fields too, is that the body is essentially just kind of stuck in the sympathetic side of things. So to some level, like it's stuck in this hyperactivity, hyperstimulation or whatever, whether it's stimulating the immune system or the cardiovascular system driving blood pressure or whatever. It's just that like the human is stuck in that stress response to some degree above what the normal like baseline is, and the body never reverts to like the state where repair goes on, or is that
you're on the right track? But there's a, it's kind of like it's, it varies across the population. We know there's a genetic component that makes you. We know environment plays a big role in your stress responses because this is an adaptive response. It's supposed to gear up if you have repeated threats. If you're a zebra out there and you have a poor sympathetic response, you probably get eaten because you didn't notice the lion while you're eating the grass and everybody else did, right? However, you see that lion, you have a response. You learn. The next lion, respond quicker. The next lion, quicker, better, faster. This is an adaptive system. So if you harm people or you give them chronic pain or you dismiss them or what, you know, and you know, they're frustrated. Yeah, this thing kind of gears up and people had it, right? So on the other hand, I've never studied the Dalai Lama, but I'd love to study people who are really skilled at lowering their heart rate and so forth to see if they have the opposite. You know, if they've been able to develop tools to get the parasympathetic really high. I don't know them. I'd like to look at that. But so it's,
I would bet they do. I mean, if you flex a muscle, it grows stronger.
I would think so, but it's a skill, you know. Some people can do a meditation and biofeedback, and some people try really hard and they just can't get it to do anything, right? So everybody's a little different, right? So, but you're exactly right. So this is an element of personalized medicine, right? And it's really a missing vital sign.
Have you done a bunch of self-testing with this? And can you?
Yeah, because I understand the medical consequences. So, so we actually had a paper I did at the American Autonomic Society meeting, a wonderful bunch of neurologists who studied just this, right? We looked at, let's see how many were there, about 145 tests I'd done in the last 3 years under different circumstances, not a quiet doctor's room, like pitching to raise money. Trust me, the sympathetic takes off, right? You're under a lot of duress. In Maui, looking at the ocean, and okay, the parasympathetic's a little better, right? I close a funding round. My parasympathetic's pretty good, you know, as opposed to starting off and we need funds or something. So what we did, though, is we presented those and we asked a simple question. Is it better than the old math? Because we give you both, right? We give you what's been around for 50 years plus the new. And the answer was quite definitive. The new is far more accurate and very helpful. And that shows in clinical trials too. So we have a lot of data looking at this, trying to punch holes in it, trying to figure out, you know, what's its limitations and so forth. The FDA cleared this for a doctor to use at their discretion. Not for rheumatoid arthritis, not for heart disease, at their discretion.
And it's not really risk involved. I mean, this is like a risk.
You just kind of lie there, pretty much, yeah. So 5 minutes, you know. And it's not.
But there's no risk in, like, even the data that they're getting. Like, you're not really at risk that the doctor is going to do something, like, do harm because of the outcome of the test. Like, nobody's going to come in and be like, you're too low, and they misread it, and they tell them to go do something stressful.
Well, that's right. Well, what if it's really stressful and they dismiss it, you know, and then something bad happens?
Well, then why would they even be using that test if they don't value its information?
You kind of hope that they're being, good doctors. But all those things are to be are going forward. So the company is committed to doing research in all fields of wellness and medicine, no cherry picking any particular place. We're Johns Hopkins and Harvard, but we're looking at a lot of places also. So we can start answering these questions, both what numbers are bad and why, and what can you do about it?
That's great. Well, let's talk about what you could do about it. I mean, I have a history working in a gym, working with people, and one of the most common things, even though like people come to the gym thinking that if they exercise, they're going to solve all their issues, when really, for most of the people I've worked with over the years, the biggest issue is like, oh yeah, you're under a lot of stress and you don't have a good system to navigate, you know, what that's imposing on you. And a lot of people at first just blow it off. Yeah, stress. I know how to get to that, but they don't really understand the implications of it. And it's really hard to change your lifestyle in a way, especially if you have the common demands that people have, like jobs and kids and whatever, maybe taking care of a parent, whatever the thing is. But I'm curious, like in your experimentation, did you do any like before and after interventions, like personally, where I took a supplement or I started a meditation or a certain type of exercise or whatever, and then see, have you been able to move the needle on your test individually, your N of one?
Yeah. So again, I'm going to speak now as a physician, practicing physician, not the CEO of InMedics. Okay. So if you look at the world's literature on the older HRV, it's not bad. It's just kind of a blunt instrument. Yes. Tai Chi, meditation, acupuncture, all these things improve HRV. One of the best studied in medicine is sleep apnea. Sleep apnea is a problem where you don't move air very well. So the autonomic nervous system says breathe, you know, and you move the air, you survive the evening and the challenge of moving air around. But it puts tremendous strain on your heart because of that sympathetic fight or flight adrenaline all the time, right? And it leads to heart consequences. That's why we don't want to miss sleep apnea. They have shown in the medical literature that the old-fashioned heart rate variability is a very good screen for sleep apnea. That's the old kind. Ours hasn't been tested for that yet. And if you treat the sleep apnea successfully, the autonomic response to the low oxygen comes back to normal in about 5 months. Takes a while. The brain doesn't give in real quick, right? But it's there to protect you.
It's trying to save your life.
Right. So again, it's nice to have a number, because if you tell me, okay, you need to eat kale the rest of your life, I'm willing to do it, but it better do something for me. Because I don't like kale. So otherwise, I'm going back to the Ben and Jerry's. So the whole idea is, give me a target. And the patients actually tell us about this technology, because again, we're in Washington, Oregon, Michigan, and Florida to get started here. We're a very new, young company. And it's the patients that are telling me, test me again. I just tried my yoga. I just tried my this, that. It's fascinating when you have a target. I mean, when you have something. The nice thing about it is you now have an FDA-cleared precision target. But you're exactly right.
It's interesting. The sleep really resonates with me. I have a little trouble staying asleep through the night, and I know there's a stress response there. And I'm trying some things to try to improve it, but it might take a little bit of time. But like last night, actually, I think I have to congratulate you. You're in Seattle. Last night was the Super Bowl. So like I was up. Are you a Seattle fan?
We were there.
Okay.
We were there.
Oh, okay. So I was up later than – I usually go to bed pretty early, but I did watch the end of the game. And today I feel like if I was testing my HRV today, it would be a little high. And I don't test it. And I don't test it because I know me and I think it'll make me crazy. Because I think I'll probably divert too much of my lifestyle to try to gamify that number. And I don't think that's a great way. I like the idea of when I visit my doctor, just doing a baseline and getting a reading every 6 to 12 months or whatever. But if I had a daily number for the, I think I would get my own way, if you will.
And actually, New York Times, I think Wall Street Journal, some other publications have said exactly that in the last 6 months. With all the fitness trainers out there and so many people wearing the Oura Ring and all these things, right? Yeah, they are noticing that people are getting paranoid about stuff. The difference is, if you have an accurate FDA cleared number, it's probably something you could take seriously. So, and then the other is, if you do something about it, gets better, you can take seriously it's helping you. I studied fibromyalgia. I'm sure you've got lots of people who listen to you. That's a problem that's poorly understood, where people have amplified pain, stiffness, cognitive problems. I was the guy who helped discover how dopamine ran that, and we did clinical trials to actually help people a lot with that.
What do you mean ran that? Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so the first dopamine evidence came from McGill, a guy named Patrick Wood, who looked at PET scans to show that people with fibromyalgia don't make as much dopamine in their central brain as the people who age match controls. That was number one. And for years, people thought, I was told, people with fibromyalgia are making stuff up, which was nonsense. It was very dismissive. It's terrible. It's very embarrassing if physicians would ever do that. So it turned out it was completely true. And the dopamine played a role in the autonomic fight or flight response. See, to get fibromyalgia, you have to lose your deep restorative sleep that restores your muscles. Athletes know all about it, your cognition, your fatigue. I mean, the deep sleep is really valuable, right? And we all tend to lose it a little bit as we get older. Children tend to preserve it some. But the sleep disturbance is not a problem of the sleep center. It's a problem of the autonomic nervous system. And let me explain just one little anecdote here. I tell people the way an alarm clock works. It doesn't wake you up, and they look at me crazy. No, it doesn't wake you up. It turns on your fight or flight response, which then triggers your sleep center to wake up. Same with smoke, same with a crying baby. It all is about the arousal that's controlled by the autonomic nervous system. So the way we made progress in fibromyalgia to restore the sleep that these poor folks needed so desperately they couldn't get on their own was, we didn't try to make them sleep. We tried to let them sleep, turn off the arousal that was interfering with their sleep. And that's really a much more constructive way to go after sleep in the first place.
What were the
That's not the party line. You know?
What were the common strategies you used for those folks to turn it down?
Well, there's a lot of things. One is all the de-stressing things that you know about. Stay away from stimulants at night, heavy meals, exercise before you go to bed. Although that can be paradoxical. I sleep better if I exercise at night, but so everybody's not the same. And the other is to understand how it works. And for the clinician, whoever's helping you, to try to identify all the things that are impeding and sort of acting on your sleep center. We know that certain kinds of cervical spinal cord issues where people put their neck back, they don't like hairdresser sinks, they activate the sympathetic nervous system. They don't even know they're doing it. That turned out to be really important. 70% of fibromyalgia patients have this thing called positional cervical cord compression. You can see on a special MRI, it's treatable, but they don't know they have it. So understanding how sleep works, understanding the autonomic, and really...
treatable with what? Like chiropractic or...
Yeah, the chiropractors were helping people too. There are some medications that are not FDA cleared, but they're used by folks who study quadriplegia. You know, they've been studying cervical.
It sounds like it's a structural thing.
Right. It is. And there's a very interesting PT program that says Feldenkrais and all kinds of other very innovative postural awareness things that remarkably good. I'll tell you. I'm the first person to admit I was wrong when my therapist said, let me try with this. I said, Sue, how are you supposed to make a tube bigger? I mean, it's a tube of bone and discs that holds the spinal canal and cord with fluid. And it squeezes when you move it. It's like a hose that kinks, right? An old hose. How are you supposed to fix that with physical therapy? I mean, you make a tube bigger. I was wrong. She was right. So
that I understand. It's the medicine I don't understand. I don't understand how you could take a pill that wouldn't fix that.
Yeah, well, remember, have you ever hit your funny bone, your ulnar nerve?
Yeah.
Yeah, zing, right? Nerve structures do not like to be bumped. If you bump your brain, it's called concussion, right? The spinal cord is a concussive force. That nerve tissue is really active. So that's why it's floating in fluid. It's designed not to be bumped. But discs wear out, ligaments, you know, people have whiplash, whatever. It can be bumped and it can be squeezed more often than you might think. So there are medicines that have been studied for years to try to reduce seizures. That's an irritated nerve, you know, cells cause a seizure. And they're applied for people with quadriplegia who've had cervical injury, that raw ending of the cord that doesn't go down. It just, you know, just stays active like a fire, right? There are people who study that and try to help people with that. So, it's kind of specialized knowledge, but it's in the rehab world more than like neurology.
Before we begin today's episode, I want to share something really special with you, something I've been pouring my heart into. If you've been feeling tired in a way that sleep doesn't fix, if you've noticed you're carrying tension all the time, or you're stuck in that cycle of pushing, achieving, caring for everyone else, and running on empty, I've created something just for you. It's a weekend retreat called The Deep Unwind, and I'll be guiding it in person at the beautiful Art of Living Retreat Center in the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Carolina. This experience is for the helpers, the overthinkers, the high achievers, the sensitive souls, the ones who are strong for everyone else, but craving a safe place to finally put down the heavy weight of responsibility and let their shoulders relax. Together, we'll spend the weekend slowing down and gently unwinding the patterns that lead to burnout and self-criticism. Through somatic practices, guided hypnotherapy, nervous system healing, and myofascial release, you'll learn how to feel safe in your body again. You'll learn how to soften your inner critic, and you'll experience how to truly rest, not just collapse or detach, but to deeply restore. You'll leave feeling lighter, clearer, more grounded, and more connected to yourself than you've felt in a long time. And everyone who joins us will receive a myofascial release kit with my favorite tools that I personally use and teach with, plus a signed copy of my book so you can continue the work at home. If this sounds like exactly what your nervous system has been asking for, I'd love to meet you there. You can learn more and reserve your spot at themindfulmovement.com/retreat. I look forward to welcoming you to The Deep Unwind.
If you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you've probably heard me talk about how important it is to regulate your nervous system. This goes for healing, for focus, for just overall emotional well-being. But the reality is that even if we know the tools to help do this, whether it's breathing or meditation or just slowing down, it can still be really hard to stay regulated throughout a busy day. That's one reason I've really been interested in the Apollo Wearable by Apollo Neuro. Sarah and I both use this device regularly and have found it very beneficial. It's a small wearable device that uses gentle vibrations, and they're designed to signal safety to your nervous system. What's fascinating is that those signals can help your body shift out of a stress state and into a calmer, more regulated state. What I like about it, most of all, is that even though it can work great alongside practices like meditation or breath work, the real value is that you can wear it throughout your day, even while you're at work, and just let it work its magic on your nervous system. The other standout use that I rely on is wearing it to bed. Not only does it help me fall asleep fast, but I often wake up around 3 a.m. and I can just tap the button on it and it will help lull me back to sleep quickly. If you want to learn more, check out the podcast episode with the founder, David Rabin, and you could explore more about the technology itself. But if you're someone that struggles with anxiety or feeling wired or overwhelmed, or you're simply looking for more nervous system support in daily life, it might be something worth exploring. You can learn more about the Apollo Wearable and how it works and save $99 on a new device at apolloneuro.com/mindful or click the link in the show notes. I promise you won't regret this investment. I truly believe it's the best bang for the buck in the wellness tech space.
So everything I learned was from the quadriplegic docs who are the Paralympic teams in Vancouver, Andrei Krasiakoff. He's the guy who taught me all this. They don't teach rheumatologists this stuff. But we had to find out what to do to have some kind of game plan to help these poor people, because the irritation of the cord activates the sympathetic fight or flight, which fragments the sleep, which leaves you with fibromyalgia. Right? So you just got to put the pieces together. So, and then you got to work your way backwards.
In a perfect world, somebody would be able to take this, or even at home, put it on their wrist, get a reading, and then push a button and it just fix it. But we're not there yet, but what you're saying is
antibiotics that kind of do that for things, you know,
to fix the HRV, to like improve the HRV. For you, essentially. But the idea is you're creating a standardization of like the language of this is what we're tracking, this is why we're tracking it. And now to all you practitioners in all the different fields, whether it's Western, Eastern, whatever, go practice solutions. And this is the tool you could utilize to track progress, essentially, on the level of the nervous system.
It's like a blood pressure cuff. Stress.
Circling back, because I think I don't want to say you dodged the answer, but I don't know if you really
answered,
but with yours, did you have any personal interventions that moved the needle for you? And if so, like how long did it take to see that?
About 25 years. So first I got my hands on the tool. Then I said, is this thing relevant? Is it accurate? Is this just more hype? Because, you know, you're always sold stuff. So we did eventually a double blind prospective study. Again, I'm speaking as a physician here because you asked me this question.
I mean, like personally though, because you
did. Oh yeah. Well, this was in my office.
No, I don't mean personally on your patients. I mean on you, Ms. Andrew.
Well, I have a pretty normal sympathetic nervous system.
So you didn't have any problems.
Physician heal yourself kind of thing. I've always emphasized my entire life sleeping as long as I can, you know.
Nice.
You know, I like to sleep because it works. It drives my wife crazy. She says, you're still a 5-year-old. My head hits the pillow, I fall asleep in 30 seconds. Drives her crazy. Has for 40 years. I may have other things to work on, but not generally my autonomic nervous system.
So your HRV is dialed in.
It's pretty good for my age, yeah. So, but I focus on understanding the problem, so I'm not frightened by it. I'm not a mystery. So if it is off, I usually can put it in context. Like, am I getting sick with something? You know, these fitness trackers, they'll tell you you're sick and you'll know tomorrow. You know, gotcha. You can pick stuff up pretty quick.
So then maybe getting back to the patients then, other than someone that has sleep apnea that they just address and then everything's improved, what are some other common things that people used successfully?
Yeah. Let me just start with rheumatoid arthritis, because that's my world, right? It's a very crippling, devastating disease where it kills you sooner than it should. So vagus nerve stimulation. It's the vagus nerve. You hear a lot of stuff about the vagus. It runs through the neck, goes to the heart, goes down to the spleen. It was a stimulant, a little vitamin-sized stimulant implant was just approved by the FDA that literally treats rheumatoid arthritis.
But it's an implant.
Yeah. Now, they're working on external ones.
There's a bunch of external ones. Yeah.
Yeah. Nisos had an external one at failed trials. You know, you got to study these things, you know, rigorously. And so, but there are people working on all kinds of interesting ideas. But the whole idea is to hijack the vagus nerve, stimulate that parasympathetic to bring the sympathetic down, right? Its first use case was epilepsy. FDA cleared 15 years ago. Not news to anybody. But an autoimmune disease. Now, that's an interesting linkage between the brain and the immune system, right? The other one is we don't have really medicines that do this. There's some anecdotal stuff. There's some over-the-counter wellness things that I can't really talk about because it's other people's work. They're kind of filing patents and things. But it'll come out, I think, the next year. You're going to see all kinds of things. And a lot of it's going to be things that make sense. They're logical. You know, you have to train people to do things. So I'm from Seattle, so east meets west there, right? So I got a lot of patients say, geez, don't give me another pill. Can I do Tai Chi, meditation, wellness? You know, yeah, please do, right? The difference now is I can check you in 6 weeks to see if you're actually changing the biology.
Well, there's a lot of technologies out there now that are like wellness tech to help reduce stress that have, I think, been shown to lower HRV. Or I guess it's razor HRV, but they're not measuring HRV obviously with like the tool you have, but we've had some of the like representatives from those companies on the podcast, and I've used a bunch of tools myself that definitely move the needle on at least your perceived state of stress.
Right, right. That's the world in front of us. You've seen much more of it than your average person because you have an interest in this, and the rest of us are just catching up. You know, trying to catch up.
Have you used any of the technologies out there with any of your patients? I want to know, what else have people used other than the free things like Tai Chi or meditation?
Yeah. Well, right now for a guy like me, right, we never miss the spinal cord business. We do special MRIs for it. We never miss sleep apnea ever. We follow some of the guidelines that are off label by the quadriplegia people. And then I've never given anybody a vagus nerve stimulator, but that was just approved. It could be relevant to these terrible diseases I take care of. But the rest of medicine will just be going other directions. I'm just excited to see what innovative people can do, especially as long as it's safe and affordable. You know, I don't want to put people in the poorhouse. Some things get pretty expensive, you know, and you wonder if it really works or not.
I think the expensive things can work. Like I have tools that are a few hundred dollars that seem to work. Right. And I also have a tool that probably works the best for me, but it's like $8,000, which is not as accessible. But it's nice that we have options out there. There's also, there was a book written, I think kind of back in the day. I don't remember the author's name, but it was like accessing the healing power of the vagus nerve. And surprisingly, the main tool that was being used was like eye exercises because of there's something about crossing the hemisphere where when you're toggling when you're like toggling activity from one hemisphere of the brain to the other, so it has to do with like eye exercises going side to side. I think people have done it with auditory, like where you're having sounds go from side to side, anything that's like, I don't know, shifting attention or awareness or something that has like this calming effect. And I don't know if it's because if you were not in a state of stress, like you'd be able to do that. It's something like you wouldn't do if you were being chased by a tiger. So it's some kind of like upward communication to the brain. Like from what I understand, the vagus nerve, primarily, I think, the information is more northbound. It's like the body telling the brain what's the state of environment? Is there something to be run from? So these things that might run in the background on the autonomic nervous system, like breath or your eyes or whatever, we can interact with, take over that, control the dial for a little bit, and take the advantage of that and like kind of direct the information that is being sent up, that we're in a place of safety and security, and that the nervous system could chill out.
You know, you're exactly right. This is an excellent point you make. 75% of the fibers in the vagus nerve go from the periphery to the brain. So the brain is constantly monitoring your physiology, many different kinds of it. And a lot of it's through the vagus nerve. 25% go the other way, give instructions, do this, do that. Make acid, bowel motility, immune system, heart rate. You know, those are the ones that the brain's directing. But your autonomic nervous system is your command and control center for everything, pretty much. And so we're, again, it's an exciting, exciting time. One of my first investors is an internist I've known forever, and he's a wonderful guy. And he says, autonomic medicine, that's what he calls it, will be to this century what infectious disease was to the last. Because at the turn of 1900, they didn't have the antibiotics, you know. And then the sulfa antibiotics came, and then a bunch of other antibiotics came. And then finally we had some other ones, you know. I mean, it was transformative to have all those antibiotics and antivirals that cured hepatitis C. I mean, that happened in my career. That's amazing. How HIV is a chronic disease, not what it was when I was in med school. So infectious disease has gone through an amazing metamorphosis. Autonomic medicine is really looks like the next step of actionable wellness healthcare opportunities, even before genomics.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I buy it. I mean, it's like lifting up the rug. You might not be finding out what the underlying stress is, but at least you're going upstream higher to interact with like the outcome. Like, for instance, stress could come in a lot of ways, but you alluded to the earlier that like you're not gonna find someone with chronic disease that's not stress, because the stress came first. Now that might come in like physical trauma, emotional trauma, infection, lack of sleep, lack of sun, lack of human connection, like whatever the thing the organism is lacking, you know, there was some demand that needed to be met that wasn't being met, and then your nervous system try to help you survive by turning on, like you said, it's kind of like a blunt object we have, a blunt tool, where regardless of the stress that's coming in, it seems like there's this magic black box or whatever, where we have switches. So we turn on these switches, you know, with their hormones, and we inhibit these switches. And then the outcomes will be like all the things that take us out. And they might vary based on what your genetics are and what the particular environmental or what the particular stress was. But it sure seems like whatever's taking us out, there's some stress that came first. So even though you might not get to the bottom of what's causing it, at least you have a chance to interact closer to the source, to the root cause, which is a much better Band-Aid while you're trying to figure out the ultimate, whether it's sleep apnea or whatever.
It's a much more holistic approach.
For sure, yeah.
The bad news is there are people just wired and their sympathetic is more active. Their whole family is that way. You know, they didn't ask for it. They didn't want it. And they're all that way. Yeah, and there's other people who are
still wonder, like,
parasympathetic, and they didn't do anything to help themselves. They're just that way. So, you know,
well, I wonder,
it's like,
how
I
much
wanted
of
to be
that
a basketball player, but I wasn't tall enough.
Right. You know? Well, it might be a little different.
Some people
are
6'4", 6'8".
Because you could have somebody who their whole family is stressed, but you find out, you know, going back, their childhood was like a real stressful environment. And
could be.
They could all come from that. They could all have that same environmental effect. So what if somebody, like, these are not home units. This is something.
Yes,
how does somebody go about either learning more, or let's say they want to get tested? Is this accessible yet to the public? Or
you know, we're just a little fledgling company run by angel investors.
Okay.
So we're going to be launching 50 of these units this summer, and we'll be spreading them out. Right now, there are two in Seattle, one in Lincoln City, Oregon, one in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and one in Miami. The one at Johns Hopkins is being used for chronic Lyme disease research. And that's just how we're, you know, we're a little tiny company. We don't have any VC love or any of that kind of stuff. We'll take some. But so if anybody has interest, the probably the easiest thing to do is to go to the website, InMedix, InMedix, stands for Innovative Medical Discovery, InMedix.com. And that's the first place to get started. You can Google that and kind of get a head start on things. 2 weeks ago, very nice article in The Economist, of all places, on HRV. So I encourage people to just Google The Economist HRV. Nice description of really what's this all about. You know, it didn't have a lot of medical, but it really was interesting, fascinating technology that was, you know, you could absorb it. You know.
Well, The Economist is generally pretty thick. Not everybody could absorb that.
You're going to be surprised. You're going to be surprised. They did a really good job.
So where do you see this like going for? If things go well for what you have in mind and your company, and how do you see this unfolding, or what do you hope to see how it unfolds, where like 5 years down the road, how is this integrated into the, I guess, the wellness space or the medical system?
You know, if there's something important to your patient's welfare, and you ignore it as a physician at your peril, which no physician wants to do. Every doctor goes to work hoping they can be the best doctor they can be. And I see this as my personal opinion, but it again, I've been around a while. I see this as a vital sign. That's how I see it. So if it were possible, this would be available to everybody in every doctor's office if the doctor chose to use it. And if the patients wanted it, it'd be available.
What kind of price point do you see it being to be?
Well, right now it's paid for by insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, and Blue Cross Blue Shield, Aetna. And we intentionally did not value price it. We charge, it's at $235 for this 5-minute high fidelity test. People told us they could charge a lot more for it because the value was there. We said no. This is the kind of test that a doctor needs access to repeatedly if they want to. And it's very important. It's not a burden, at least an undue burden, on either the doctor, the staff, patients, or the system, anybody. So there's also a health equity kind of issue here. You know, this has to be, all you need is the internet and a plug, you know, and it runs on a battery. So you can take it out to rural areas, places that, you know, they don't have a big university nearby.
How big are we talking about the device?
Oh, it's the size of a laptop.
Okay.
Four wires that are 11 feet long. You lie on a table. You push a button. It's got an iPad screen. So, and again, on the website, it's all right there. So, yeah. So the whole point was it had to work for me as a physician. Had to work for my staff. It certainly had to help my patients. It's designed so that if people want to make advances and discover things, and you know they have an anchor now, they can decide, okay, I have this idea. Well, let's see if it really works. Well, you have to have a test. So we're going to make a lot of people happy because what they're doing now in the wellness community is actually really moving the autonomic needle, and we're probably going to make some people not so happy.
Right. I've talked to a lot of the doctors over the years, and the ones I've talked to, I think, you know, it would fit right in, I think, with their philosophy. I think there's a lot of people out there that I think would really appreciate having this tool in the office to really help guide them and make their job easier to do a better job for their patient.
Nothing torpedoes my effectiveness as a physician like this issue. And, you know, it really affects my performance completely. And I just haven't had a way to, you know, get a toehold on it. And it starts with accurate precision diagnostics in the FDA. That's what's
Well, I know there's a big, I'm sure, financial incentive for you, and there's a conflict of interest here. But I got to say, I applaud you, man. I think it's great. I think it's an exciting thing that you're doing, and I think it can make the world a better place. I think that our medical system, even though it's filled with good-intended people, I think when it comes to chronic illness, the system is not set up well for them to succeed well. And I think it's tools like this that can really move the needle. So I was excited to see that you reached out. I was excited to read about what you're doing, and it's a pleasure to meet you, and I'm glad to be a conduit for the message so that more people could hear kind of what's on the horizon and what's possible. And I think it's exciting. So I thank you for, I'm sure you've put a lot of effort into getting this point, and it's on top of the 30 years of clinical practice.
10 years of my life.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm sure it's a lot, and I hope it does pay off for you, because I do think it'd be great if somebody could come in and for 250-ish bucks have that type of data. I think it's really exciting.
I might just throw one more thing out there, especially for your particular audience. If there's practitioners out there, we can't make these fast enough. So we have a waiting list of 250 clinicians who want this. But I want some of them to go into the wellness integrative medicine area, and I don't go to those meetings. It's not, I meet through this, right? It's just not where I am. So if somebody wants to go to the website, send us a little email, say, hey, I'd like to learn more, I'm happy to facilitate that. Otherwise, we won't know who you are. Love to get them out there broadly so that people smarter than me can start solving the problems of autonomic nervous system.
Gotcha. Well, I know there's a lot of people in the functional and integrative side of things that understand and are trying to use the autonomic nervous system to help their process, but a tool like that obviously would be very suitable for them, at least for now, until the rest of the medical system, they're going to move slower. That's a bigger cruise ship to kind of turn, I think.
That's right. And with my study of fibromyalgia, I was an outlier. I worked with naturopathic doctors, integrative doctors, chiropractors, that's another story,
Right.
But well, you just can't give up.
I thank you for your time. And for the listeners, always grateful for your listening and interested in any comments you have about maybe any experience you've had with things that you feel have helped move the needle for you, measuring your HRV, even though, might be a different tool that might not be, as precise, but probably the tools out there are still useful. I would think that they're at least useful, maybe not objectively across a population, but for the individual to see if something is helping or hurting. I would think that they would be at least relevant for the person using them, but maybe not comparing one person to another.
That's right. So I can't really say is it good or bad, but you can say are you better or worse.
Right.
So,
yeah.
But your doctor's got to say is it good or bad.
Right. Yeah, I get it. Well, thanks again. Thanks again for listening, everybody. I hope you enjoyed the conversation, and ask you to share it with someone that you think might also enjoy it. Have a good day, everybody.
Thank you.